ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 20th of March. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, delicate discussions. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi visits Australia again after 7 years as relations stabilise. But with sensitive topics on the agenda, how far does the goodwill go? And pill testing is coming to a music festival in Queensland. Could this be the start of a push to expand the service nationally?
Drug checking actually works best when there's more sites and that information is being actively monitored and shared. So it's really just the very beginning of what I hope is a nationwide system.
Donald Trump has cast a shadow over US-Australian relations by suggesting that current Australian Ambassador Kevin Rudd wouldn't be welcome in Washington under another Trump presidency. In an interview with a conservative media platform in the UK, Donald Trump said Australia's former Prime Minister was not the brightest bulb and that he's heard Kevin Rudd was a little bit nasty. It was in response to the former Prime Minister describing Donald Trump as a destructive president and a traitor to the West. Rima Chia reports.
The 2024 US presidential election is still months away, but that hasn't stopped Donald Trump from talking about what he might do if he's re-elected. And in an interview with former Brexit politician Nigel Farage, he made it clear he doesn't think highly of Australia's ambassador to the US, former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd.
We've got a Labor government in Australia. The previous ambassador, Joe Hockey, I think was quite a good friend of yours. You got on pretty well with him. Now they've appointed Kevin Rudd, former Labour MP. I mean, he has said the most horrible things. You were a destructive president, a traitor to the West. And he's now Australia's ambassador in Washington.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Would you take a phone call from him?
He won't be there long if that's the case. I don't know much about him. I heard he was a little bit nasty. I hear he's not the brightest bulb. But I don't know much about him. But if he's at all hostile, he will not be there long.
Fair enough.
Dr. Rudd was the president and CEO of the Asia Society prior to becoming Australia's ambassador to the US. He has previously defended comments he made about Mr. Trump, saying he made them in his capacity as an independent think tanker. Nevertheless, the incident has raised diplomatic concerns. Bruce Wolpe is a senior fellow of the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
I think Australia should take it very seriously. And I think Trump's disposition, his default position, would be to have some issues with Prime Minister Albanese. So he'll be briefed on Australian political leaders who have said hostile things about Trump and the January 6th insurrection and about abortion and about guns. And he will factor that into his thinking as to how he's going to approach the leaders in Australia.
As for possible consequences, Bruce Wolpe says Australia is diplomatically savvy enough to navigate tricky situations.
They did an excellent job in Trump's term in office from 2017 to 2021. Australia has a very sophisticated and very effective political and issues program for Washington. But then the question is, do Trump's issues with Australia and its where it sits and what it stands for and so forth, and how closely they can work together on the issues that Trump wants to be confrontational on with other countries? Well, that's where it comes into play.
And if the relationship deteriorates further, could Donald Trump remove Kevin Rudd from the post?
No, he doesn't have that explicit power. But there's always consultation between two governments as to who they're going to send as ambassadors. But this will be a hypercharged atmosphere with a president who represents a different strand of American posture in the world. And so these things will be taken very seriously with the comments of former President Trump.
The US-Australia relationship isn't the only item on Mr. Trump's agenda. US funding for NATO is also in his sights.
Why should we guard these countries that have a lot of money and the United States was paying for most of NATO? Nope, I'm not going to pay you. We're not going to do it. We're not going to defend you. If you're not paying your bills, we're not going to defend you. It's very simple.
Mr. Trump and President Joe Biden both secured their party's nominations for the presidential race after winning state primary elections last week. Recent poll suggests the candidates are neck and neck ahead of the poll in November.
Rima Chia reporting, and the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, says the government maintains great faith in Kevin Rudd as Australia's representative in the US.
Mr. Rudd is a very effective ambassador. He is recognised across this parliament, as doing an excellent job in advancing Australia's interests in the United States. And I'd point you in particular to the phenomenal amount of work which has been done on AUKUS in the period that he's been ambassador. He's been extremely active in engaging with members of Congress on both sides of politics, and his experience and skills mean he will be able to work closely with whomever is elected by the American people as the United States president.
Foreign Minister Penny Wong. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi has arrived in Australia and praised Canberra's air quality. But what will the atmosphere be like inside the meeting room when he sits down with Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong? She plans to raise difficult topics such as trade barriers, human rights abuses, and the fate of Australian citizen Yang Heng Jun, who's been sentenced to death on spying charges. And there's one more thing that's likely on the agenda, whether Adelaide's pandas will be sent back to China. Angus Randall reports.
Outside Adelaide Zoo, fans are queuing up for two rock stars, giant pandas Wong Wong and Funi.
Pandas, black and white.
I'm pretty.
See the pandas? Eating bamboo.
They're just cute.
The first thing they're asking me about and want to go see, and there's the statues of them.
I guess they're a draw card and the children love them, so it would be great if they could stay in Adelaide.
The pandas have been on loan from China since 2009. Their contract expires in November. Elaine Benstead is the chief executive of Zoos SA. She says 15 years on, the pandas remain a huge draw card.
When we do our market research, giant pandas are still the most popular area within Adelaide Zoo. And the tourism value can't be understated. We do a VIP panda tour where people can get a bit closer into the pandas. More than 80% of the people who undertake that tour are from interstate. And that's booked out 2 months in advance.
Wong Wong and Funi are more than just bamboo-eating machines. They're de facto diplomats. China holds a tight control over the pandas it sends overseas, and a nation that angers China can lose its panda privileges. The United Kingdom returned its pandas last year. Most of America's pandas have been sent back to China in the past few years. Elaine Benstead says China's panda experts are happy with how the Adelaide bears are tracking, but it's up to the politicians.
There's a whole other political layer which, to be honest, that's outside my pay grade. I'll let Penny Wong to manage all of that, because we do know it is, you know, it is seen. They are seen as the Chinese national treasures, and so they make decisions about which countries can have the honour of hosting giant pandas quite carefully.
Foreign Minister Penny Wong has a lot more on her agenda than pandas. There's been an ongoing thawing of relations under this government after the previous Morrison government was heavily critical of China.
As you know, dialogue enables us to manage our differences. We both know it does not eliminate them. Australia will always be Australia and China will always be China. Now more than ever, it is important that we have channels to discuss upholding a regional and global order shaped by agreed rules and norms where we respect each other's sovereignty.
Speaking through a translator, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi says the nations share common interests.
So we should not only face the differences and express them squarely, but also manage and rise above the differences. As Prime Minister Albanese said, we should not let differences dominate our relations.
Richard McGregor is Senior Fellow for East Asia at the Lowy Institute. He says this trip needs to be about more than just healing.
Mr. Albanese, I think, met Xi Jinping in December 2022. So the stabilisation narrative now has been going on for some time and becoming, in some respects, slightly calcified. How do we move beyond that? What are the issues that the two countries can actually cooperate on? Because, you know, at the moment, there's in some respects, certainly from the Australian side, an attempt to park or at least not fetishize differences that Australia has with China. You can't just do that. You have to have a positive agenda.
Shadow Foreign Minister Simon Birmingham is also meeting with Wang Yi.
Ensuring that China honours the terms of the trade agreement that it voluntarily entered into with Australia is critical. The shock that Australians had from the sentencing of Yang Hengjun very recently and the expectation that he be shown compassion and fair treatment and ultimately released is something that needs to be made loud and clear.
Wang Yi is also meeting with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese today.
Angus Randall. Australian households may have revisited their budgets last night after the Reserve Bank indicated it was in no rush to lower interest rates. But there's another potential hurdle for households trying to make ends meet. The RBA has warned workers that unless productivity improves substantially, pay rises will need to be contained. For more on this, our business reporter David Taylor joined me earlier. David, what has the Reserve Bank said about wages growth and what does it mean for workers looking for a pay rise?
Well, Rachel, after dismal wages growth for the better part of a decade, the Reserve Bank says wages growth has picked up a little further from already increased rates last year. But the thing is, the Reserve Bank has basically indicated that wages growth has now peaked. Now, the current growth rate of pay packets will see inflation return to around about 2-3% by next year, which is what the Reserve Bank would be comfortable with. And RBA Governor Michelle Bullock says that that doesn't factor in recent increases in pay for aged care workers.
But let me say right up front that I don't think anyone would begrudge aged care workers a rise. They've been historically underpaid for the work they do. It's a very important job. And there's shortages in those industries. So I think it's a very worthy pay rise. I don't think personally, and I don't think our when we do put it into our forecast, I don't think it's going to make a measurable difference really to what we're forecasting. We might want to watch to see if there are some spillovers, but I'm not expecting that it's going to have a great impact.
RBA Governor Michelle Bullock there indicating that despite seeing some impressive wage increases in recent times, it shouldn't flow through to overall wages growth or inflation for that matter. But in terms of aged care workers getting up to a 28.5% wage rise in the current economic environment, what about other workers? Well, here's the NAB's chief economist, Alan Oster.
Their expectation and our expectations is that total wages growth will probably peak at around 4.3. It's currently around 4. So it'll go up a little bit more, but not a lot.
Can workers be confident that when they ask for pay rises in the near term that, you know, the system is comfortable with that, or, you know, bosses and politicians and policymakers going to be resisting it?
Oh, everyone's going to look at it, but I think basically what they're saying is that they don't expect to see the sort of wage growth acceleration that they saw last year. And you could see that the national wage case, you're not going to get another 6 because inflation by the middle of the year will be down like 3.5%. In terms of growth rates, and it's individual bargaining. So, you know, you can ask whether you get a response that's yes, depends on your employer.
That's the NAB's chief economist, Alan Oster. To put it really simply, Rachel, this looks like as good as it gets for wages growth. Now, if wages growth does continue to increase from here, economists warn this will delay the first RBA interest rate cut.
And David, another central bank, the Bank of Japan, has increased Japanese interest rates for the first time in 17 years.
So, Rachel, while this moves Japan away from a more extreme interest rate setting, it's a reminder to the world that global inflation, especially supply-driven inflation, remains too high and sticky.
David Taylor. On ABC Radio across Australia and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. International aid agencies say famine could be declared in northern Gaza in coming weeks. They point to new data which says 1.1 million people across Gaza, or at least half the population, now face catastrophic food insecurity. Alexandra Sayer is Save the Children's head of humanitarian policy and advocacy. We spoke earlier. Alexandra Sayer, can you describe the current situation in northern Gaza?
Absolutely catastrophic. Civilians have been almost completely cut off from any humanitarian assistance. They've been deprived of the basics needed to survive. They're being starved, and they are still being bombarded. The situation in northern Gaza is getting worse by the day, and yesterday it was announced that they are just days away from famine.
The UN has warned that one in three children under the age of two are now suffering from acute malnutrition. What do the next days and weeks hold?
Well, if the status quo continues, meaning if there is not a ceasefire and if Israel does not lift the restrictions impeding aid agencies like ours from delivering humanitarian assistance across the Gaza Strip, the situation is only going to worsen. 23 children have already died of malnutrition and dehydration, and we fear that these numbers are only going to skyrocket if the situation continues as is. Children and their families have been forced to live off of wheat, hay, and animal food, is what we're hearing from our staff and their families.
Is any aid getting through at all?
There is some getting through, but it's not nearly enough. And there are parts of Gaza that hadn't until recently received any aid for weeks. And so even if we were to start to get more assistance now, in many cases, the damage has been done for many of these children. Severe acute malnutrition can cause lifelong consequences for children. It impacts their long-term development, and it also makes them at higher risk of dying from common diseases like diarrhea and pneumonia. And this is why we're seeing the deaths that we're seeing now.
We heard a few weeks ago about the US building that port in the Mediterranean for the distribution of aid. How far away is that from providing relief to this situation?
Look, we were told that this would take up to 2 months. And so while all efforts are needed to get humanitarian assistance into Gaza, and we welcome more crossings open, there are truckloads of food, water, and medical supplies waiting at the border with Gaza, waiting for Israel to allow these supplies in. And so land routes remain the most effective and efficient way to deliver humanitarian assistance, and also the quickest way. And so we need all efforts, but we also need these trucks to be allowed in as soon as possible.
And you say that because of those land routes being so vital, nothing short of a ceasefire will ease that situation.
What we know is that the continued bombardment, the hostilities, has impeded safe aid delivery. We've seen shelters attacked. We've seen refugee camps attacked. And so it is not safe for us to deliver the humanitarian assistance needed at the scale needed without a ceasefire.
Alexandra Sayer, thanks for joining the world today.
Thank you for having me.
And Alexandra Sayer is Save the Children's head of humanitarian policy and advocacy. The World Meteorological Organization says things could get worse before it gets better when it comes to the climate crisis. In a new report, the UN Weather Agency says 2023 set new records for every single climate indicator, with average temperatures rising to their highest point in the 174 years of recorded history. This comes as experts gather today in Canberra for a climate forum, as Anna Pikett reports.
Some records aren't just chart-topping, they're chart-busting. The words of United Nations Secretary-General Antonio Guterres.
Earth is issuing a distress call. Fossil fuel pollution is sending climate chaos off the charts. Sirens are blaring across all major indicators. Last year saw record heat, record sea levels, and record ocean surface temperatures. Glaciers likely lost more ice than ever before. And changes are speeding up.
You probably won't be surprised to hear that this is all being driven by climate change, exacerbated by the burning of fossil fuels. Scientists are warning that 2024 could be even worse, with these factors coupled with the naturally occurring El Niño weather pattern fueling global temperatures in the first months of this year. Despite the depressing headlines, there are threads of optimism. Celeste Saulo is the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization.
I am now sounding the red alert about the state of the climate.
There is, however, a glimmer of hope. Renewable energy generation is surging. In 2023, clean energy capacity additions increased by almost 50% over 2022. Weather and climate services will be vital to power the transition to solar, wind, and hydropower.
Today, experts, politicians, and economists are meeting in Canberra for a climate integrity summit organised by think tank the Australia Institute. One of the speakers is Bill Hare, CEO of Climate Analytics and a member of the UN High-Level Expert Group on the Net Zero Emissions Commitments of Non-State Entities. He said the WMO report shows the pace of climate change is picking up.
The scale of the changes we've seen in the last year are extremely unusual. And I think it's one of the clearest warnings we've got now that the system is beginning to respond much more quickly than we would like, and that the time is now well over to delay on emission reduction action.
He says the aim of today's event is to reinforce the need to reduce emissions to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees.
One of the key obstacles emerging on that pathway is problems with what is called climate integrity. That is, countries, corporates professing to take action when they're not really.
Another of the key speakers today will be His Excellency Mr. Anota Tong, the former president of Kiribati. He believes Australia can do more.
They have done things, but still not enough. The commitment to cut emissions to zero by 2050 is very welcome. That's not the only problem. Australia is the third largest exporter of fossil fuel, and that has to be cut down because they have the capacity to become a world leader in renewable energy. And it's about making the commitment then to make that transition from fossil fuel to renewable energy.
The federal government says renewable energy sources accounted for 9% of Australian energy consumption in 2021 to 2022, with renewable electricity generation more than doubling over the last decade.
Anna Pikett reporting. The Queensland Government will fund a pill testing service at a music festival for the first time. The festival to be held over Easter will be the third in the country to offer a pill testing service as part of harm reduction measures. Advocates are hoping it's the beginning of a much wider rollout. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
In Elbow Valley, near the Queensland and New South Wales border, preparations for the Rabbit's Eat Lettuce Festival are in full swing. This year, for the first time, a pill testing service will be up and running.
It's a very exciting step in the right direction in reducing drug-related harms. And it's just, from an event organiser perspective, it's very exciting just to be able to kind of lead the charge on this.
Eric Lemire is the festival's director. He says the service will be located within a harm reduction space to provide some privacy for those who want to use it.
And then from there, they'll then go to the drug checking pill testing marquee where they can talk to one of the scientists and wait while the substances are checked, and then they're given their results and talked through the harm, potential harms of what might be in the substances. And then the team at Pill Testing Australia are then going to be able to share that data with our medical facility on site. So our paramedics and doctors on site are going to have up-to-date data on what drugs might be circulating in the event and what to look out for.
Based on that information, festival goers can then choose whether to discard the substances. In 2019, two attendees were found dead in their tent with a lethal cocktail of drugs in their systems. Eric Lemire says pill testing could reduce the risk of serious harm.
It's the last thing we want. You know, we want people to come and have a good time and enjoy the music. But, you know, we can't put our head in the sand. We know people take drugs and experiment with drugs when they're young. So anything we can do to make things as safe as possible.
Stephanie Genetis is the Executive Officer of Pill Testing Australia. She says the service is a first for Queensland after pilot programs were offered at Canberra's Groove in the Moo in 2018 and 2019.
In November last year, we delivered drug checking at Spilt Milk, and that was in compliance with the ACT government's festival pill testing policy, which came out after the 2019 pilot, ACT government funds the fixed site, the CAN test service in Canberra, run by Directions Health in partnership with PTA and Karma. And now what the Queensland government is doing is they're not funding a trial, they're funding an evidence-based service.
Queensland Health Minister Shannon Fentiman says the state government will spend $1 million to deliver pill testing services over the next 2 years. Stephanie Ginetti says drug checking works best on a large scale, so she's hoping the service will be expanded to events around the country.
Drug checking actually works best when there's more sites, when there's more data being collected, and that information is being actively monitored and shared with relevant stakeholders. So it's really just the very beginning of what I hope is a nationwide system.
Stephanie Ginetti's from Pill Testing Australia, ending that report by Elizabeth Cramsey. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Last week, hundreds of US politicians got behind a bill that would ban TikTok, unless its Chinese parent company sells it. They're worried the app could be used by the Chinese Communist Party to steal data and influence Americans. So, if it's axed in the US, will Australia do the same? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app. Thank you.